Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, Yemen is facing what observers are calling one of the worst humanitarian crises on earth. How did it get to this and what should be done? But first, raising big money is a relatively new phenomenon in academia. How did science, government, and industry get so entrenched with one another? And what has it meant for scholarly research? Michael Hiltzik joins us to talk about his latest book, Big Science: Ernest Lawrence and the Invention That Launched the Military-Industrial Complex. Welcome back to the Scholar Circle, Michael Hiltzik. It is great to have you back with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So I'm curious first why you decided to do this particular book. It seems like a departure from your past books and subjects. Why Big Science?
Well, it's a departure from some of my recent books, but not necessarily from my trend line. A number of things came together at just the right moment. First, of course, I was looking for a new subject. I had just finished and published a book on the New Deal. I've always been interested in technology and science, and I've always had sort of a hobbyist interest in things like physics and quantum mechanics and things like that. And when you read enough in that field, it isn't long before you encounter the name of Ernest Lawrence. And that's also true when, as I was doing, you cover higher education in the U.S., because higher education means a lot of money being spent on big scientific projects, and he was the father of that trend. So he's often mentioned both as the father of, as I said, big science, but also as the father of modern physics because of his invention of the cyclotron. So this was going to enable me to write about the politics of the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and the war, and physics, and technology, and to revive interest and knowledge about this very important scientific figure in the U.S. that most people had really forgotten about.
One of the things that was really remarkable was essentially Lawrence's role in transforming science from what you call small science to what we now call big science. Can you talk about the difference in what it was before Lawrence and then what we are talking about when we say big science?
Sure. Well, there was a continuum of how scientific research, particularly in chemistry and physics, was being done, and especially in physics at the time. We're talking about the very late 20s and the beginning of the 30s. And the older generation of physicists, these are people like Sir Ernest Rutherford and Marie Curie, had accomplished incredible things with the tools that nature gave them. They were using alpha ray emissions from thimblefuls of radium and other radioactive materials, and using those tools, they had discovered radioactivity and X-rays, and they had discovered the neutron, and they had figured out the internal structure of the atom itself. But they also understood that they had basically come to the end of that process, that to delve further into the atomic nucleus, they were going to need projectiles and tools of much greater energies, and that those were not going to be available from natural minerals, that it was going to require using man's ingenuity to build up those energies. And it was Rutherford himself who said, I would like to see an apparatus that can give me 10 electron volts and yet fit in a comfortably sized room. So he sort of set out that challenge to the younger generation, and Lawrence was there at the right moment. He had the right intuitions and the right instinct, and he discovered the way to do that, and that was the cyclotron. It was a way of placing energies on the projectile, in his case, initially protons, and driving them to higher energies without trying to put the energy onto the apparatus itself. And this was a really radical new concept, and he was able to put it into action.
The original cyclotron was really small compared to what it developed into. Tell us a little about what the cyclotron did, the size of it, and then its future, like the Hadron Collider, for example. So walk us through what it did and its size and then its progeny.
Sure. The cyclotron concept was based on the fact that if you send a charged particle through a magnetic field, its path will curve. So Lawrence understood that if you send a proton, which has a positive charge of 1, through a magnetic field, you can twist it into a spiral, and that allows you to jolt it with new energies every time it crosses the same electrode gap. Now, that was the concept. It took a couple of years for him to actually get it to work, and his first cyclotron fit in the palm of his hand. It looked like a flask, a glass or metal flask that had been run over by a truck. It was slathered with red sealing wax to keep a vacuum inside it, and it cost less than $100 in material. Once he got that or its next generations working, every time he got new energies, he raised new questions about what these could do. So every generation of the cyclotron had to be bigger, it had to be more powerful. Inevitably, it was more expensive, and over a period of really less than a decade, he had gone from that little palm-sized unit to a cyclotron that needed a building to be built for it in a ravine above the Berkeley campus, and that was going to cost more than $1 million. This, of course, was a process that soon outstripped the ability of a university to pay for, even a consortium of universities, and that's why Lawrence began to turn to research foundations and the government and eventually industry as well. And that's how big science came about. Forward to the present day, the Large Hadron Collider is the largest atom smasher in the world. It occupies a tunnel that's 17 miles in circumference. It's buried under the border between France and Switzerland, and it costs $9 billion to build. And what it's got in it is several cyclotrons and synchrocyclotrons and other offspring of Lawrence's original concept. So you can see sort of the evolution of these machines over time.
The Large Hadron Collider is really the essence of big, which you noted in your book, titled Big Science, of course, that took, what, 25 years, I think you said, $10 billion. How can we understand just how big this really is?
Well, I think we can understand it by, there's actually a photograph in my book of a man standing inside the tunnel of the Large Hadron Collider, and of course he's dwarfed by the machinery around him, and you compare that to a unit that fit in the palm of somebody's hand. And of course, the energies that these devices can produce today are unimaginable. They were even unimaginable to somebody with the imagination of an Ernest Lawrence, who himself was thinking way ahead of his own contemporaries. But you now need those energies to essentially create or to see at least the signs of new particles that are themselves the building block of subatomic particles and the atom and the world we live in.
I think one of the most important results that we saw from Lawrence was, as you mentioned, the military-industrial complex, the bombs, the World War II, but also the academy. He was the first to really go after all this money and convince the government to put its resources into science, and then the development of big science as an institution in of itself. So I wonder if we could walk through each of these. Perhaps we should start with, you mentioned the first time a scientist had started going to foundations, going to the government. Tell us a little bit about how he did this and how it developed into today.
Yeah, I think that scientific research was sort of lucky in having a person like Lawrence in that place at that time. His personality really lent itself to this sort of, to being an impresario, to being a ringleader and a manager. He was a prototypical CEO of a research center. He was amiable. He was smart. He knew how to talk to university presidents and foundation chairmen and industrial CEOs very easily. It may have had a lot to do with his upbringing as a small-town boy in rural South Dakota. He was very American. He had an air about him that was very different from the stern European mien of physicists of the past. So his personality really lent itself to his ability to do that. And, of course, he had this other quality, which is that when he promised that he would achieve something, he almost always delivered on that promise. So if he was going to the Rockefeller Foundation or the Macy Foundation, which was doing a lot of funding of medical research, and he could say, look, you know, this is my goal, this is what I'm going to do, they could look at his record and they could see that he actually had achieved what he had promised the last time around. And, you know, he was somebody who always had the next machine on the drawing board when the last one was still being built. So he brought these people along with him. His enthusiasm was really infectious. And, of course, the fact that he actually could deliver was very, very important at this stage when he's out there on the very leading edge of physics. Now, the point came when the needs for his technology really went beyond even what foundations could do, what corporations could do. And at that moment, we were about to enter the war, and the government was in the mode of becoming the most important patron of basic scientific research. And there was Lawrence. He was very friendly with the scientific leadership of the government at the time, and he moved very smoothly into the patronage of the government from industry and foundations and universities.
I got the sense from reading your book that this kind of raised eyebrows at the time, that a lot of scientists weren't really comfortable with this cozy kind of relationship and their concerns about strings attached. What are the ethical concerns that were raised at the time, and integrate them into what you see today?
There was sort of a series of phases. You have to remember that when this process really began, first of all, when he was dealing with universities and foundations, there weren't a lot of ethical concerns raised by other scientists. They understood that these were entities devoted to basic science. They were willing to allow the scientists that they were funding to follow their own noses. At the point that he began to get involved with the military, we were entering the war, and most of the scientific community, particularly the physics community, was very interested in doing this sort of work because a lot of them had come from Germany and Austria. They were very, very panicky about the thought that Hitler would get his hands on the secrets of nuclear fission and create a bomb that they knew was at least plausible and feasible. So at the point that Lawrence began to develop his relationship with the government and the military, the rest of the scientific community was okay with that. They had a job to do. It was an urgent job, and Lawrence helped organize the Manhattan Project. He played a key role in the scientific management of that project. And I think most of his colleagues had faith that he knew what he was doing and that he would protect them from political interference, and he did. Now, that became harder to do in the post-war period when many of the scientists who had worked on the Manhattan Project began to have second thoughts about the work they had done, no matter how urgent and important they thought it was at the time, and especially once the U.S. government began to get very interested in the hydrogen bomb. This was a new technology. Many of the physicists who had worked on the atomic bomb were very uncomfortable with it. They viewed it as a weapon that would be good only for genocide or as a psychological menace. Many of them did not want to work on it, but it was Lawrence who kept pushing it ahead. And that, I think, led to a lot of doubts about the propriety of working with Lawrence and with the government at that time. The government in the post-war years was much more interested in attaching strings to its patronage. A lot of physicists who wanted to move back into civilian life were very uncomfortable with that. So you began to see this real split within the scientific community about these relationships, really starting after 1945.
There were some problems, of course, too, in his science. He got sort of busted at one of the conferences that dealt with the deuteron and having contaminated the results. What did that mean in this big picture?
We're going back to the 1930s now, and this was a period in which Lawrence himself was sort of learning how to be a scientist. I think it's something that many scientists have to go through. They have to learn how to divorce their thrill with the technology that they have on hand from the need to actually come up with results. Lawrence and his team at Berkeley in the early days, they were really focused on building up the technology, on building bigger cyclotrons that were more and more capable. And in that era, actual scientific research often took took a back seat to this desire to build the machine. As I said, in the radiation lab, which was Lawrence's lab at Berkeley, you could be forgiven for not bringing a scientific project to fruition, but you could not be forgiven for missing your shift tending the cyclotron. A lot of scientists just, you know, could not deal with that. He lost a few very talented men, but many saw that once the cyclotron was perfected, the ability to do research would be great. But in the process, Lawrence got a lot of things wrong. His team missed a couple of very important developments. They missed the discovery of artificial radiation, which was discovered by Marie Curie, even though they had the best equipment to make this discovery. And the deuteron affair, which you just mentioned, involved what Lawrence thought was his discovery of what was going on when a deuteron, that's the nucleus of a helium atom, strikes a target within the cyclotron. He used his findings to develop a theory about the weight of the neutron, which other scientists, much more experienced scientists, especially at Cambridge University in England, thought was wrong. And then he presented his results at a very important scientific conference in Brussels, and he was shown to be wrong. He had to climb down. His reputation was really at risk because experienced researchers thought that he had been incompetent in doing this. He had tried to claim results that were not supported by the data. And I think he learned a lot from that. He learned humility, certainly, and he learned really the need to do the actual research much more rigorously. And that, I think, was a turning point for his lab. And after that, they didn't make that mistake again.
So let's bring in Oppenheimer now. He was, as you described, the great theorist, whereas Lawrence was a great experimentalist. So we're fast forwarding now. You said their relationship was quite enigmatic, but also probably the most responsible for developing big science. How would you describe that relationship before Oppenheimer got into some trouble?
Robert Oppenheimer got to Berkeley a year or so after Ernest did, and as you said, Oppenheimer was probably the most talented physics theorist in the United States at the time. Lawrence's grasp of theory was not always very strong, but he was a great experimentalist, and of course Oppenheimer was useless around a machine. So they had a symbiotic relationship. They had a great relationship. And at the beginning of this time, they were very, very close friends. Lawrence's first son, Robert, was named after Oppenheimer. The family socialized together. They were very, very close. But they were very different. And in fact, a lot of their colleagues spent half their lives trying to figure out what drew Ernest Lawrence and Robert Oppenheimer together, and then spent half their lives trying to figure out what led to their very, very bitter breakup later in their lives. As you said, it was an odd relationship. Started out very warm. It ended very bitter. But at the key moments from the 1930s and into the 1940s, it was very, very close. In fact, it was Lawrence who nominated Oppenheimer to run the lab that would become Los Alamos under the Manhattan Project. And he even had to vouch for Oppenheimer when the U.S. Army said, you know, Oppenheimer's a leftist. We're not sure he's not a communist. It was Lawrence who stepped forward and said, I will keep him under control. If he runs off the rails, I will be there to fix it. And that was enough for General Leslie Groves, the head of the Manhattan Project, to basically sign off on Oppenheimer's appointment.
Eventually, his security clearance was revoked, Oppenheimer's. So what happened for the revocation to occur?
Well, that's the tragedy of Robert Oppenheimer. After the war, he not only opposed the development of the hydrogen bomb, but he spoke out against it. He became a great campaigner against nuclear proliferation and the development of thermonuclear weapons, and of course a very respected one because of his role in the war. He had been sort of a shy, mumbling figure at the beginning of the 30s when he and Lawrence first began their friendship, and he had developed into essentially a world figure, world-famous physicist, scientist, and statesman. Now, in opposing the hydrogen bomb, Oppenheimer ran afoul of a man named Louis Strauss, who was the head of the Atomic Energy Commission under Truman and Eisenhower, and was a fanatic fan of developing the hydrogen bomb. Strauss was the type of person who, if you disagreed with him, he at first thought you were an idiot and then concluded you were a traitor, and that's the way he viewed Oppenheimer. So it was Strauss who really started this campaign to revoke Robert Oppenheimer's security clearance and staged essentially a trial of Oppenheimer to revoke that clearance, in which physicists of great renown from all over the country essentially had to take sides, either for Oppenheimer or against him. The real tragedy in this relationship, I think, is that almost every physicist in the U.S., certainly every physicist who had worked in the Manhattan Project, was on Oppenheimer's side and defended him at this trial. The only people who were against him were Ernest Lawrence and his team at Berkeley. And they came very close to testifying at this procedure against Oppenheimer, and then decided that it was better for them if they just stood down and they didn't testify at all.
So do you think ultimately it was politics that divided Lawrence and Oppenheimer?
It was chiefly politics, but I think their personalities and their different lifestyles really played into this and played an important role. I think if they had political disagreements, but they were two different people than they were, I don't think it would have been as bitter a breakup as it became. You have to really think about how fundamentally different in personality these two people were. Lawrence, as I said, was a small-town boy. He was married to the same woman all his life. Robert Oppenheimer was a New Yorker, a New York City born and bred. He had been trained in Europe. He had gotten an education of a sophistication that Lawrence didn't have. He was sort of a boulevardier. He was a womanizer. He was married twice. He had a lot of affairs, including one with the wife of a very close friend of Lawrence that Lawrence thought very bitterly about. So you had all these elements. Oppenheimer was into politics. Lawrence tried to stay away from politics as much as he could, especially the sort of leftist socialist politics that Oppenheimer espoused. So you had all these elements, and when you add onto it this fundamental disagreement about a project that Lawrence was committed to and that Oppenheimer was publicly speaking out against, it was an explosive formula, and it really did end in serious breach.
Let's talk also about Lawrence's influence on medicine with his brother and with Harvey Williams Cushing. They really contributed a lot to this field of nuclear medicine. Tell us about that.
Well, a couple of things came together. First of all, Ernest was very sensitive to waves of funding in the scientific community. There was a period early in the development of the cyclotron when funding for hard physics was drying up. This is foundation funding. But funding for medical research was surging. Now, Ernest Lawrence was always on the lookout for patronage. He needed a lot of money to build his machine. So he began to think harder about what the cyclotron could do, what the technology could do for medical science. Now, his younger brother, John, was a medical doctor who was also interested in this field. So they came together and they worked together to develop what became the field of nuclear medicine. John Lawrence was one of the first professors of nuclear medicine. He got the appointment at the University of California at what was then Berkeley's Medical School, which was in San Francisco, which is now UC San Francisco. And they worked together to develop the capabilities of using radiation to diagnose and cure disease in ways that are still being used today. A lot of the machines, diagnostic equipment that's used today was pioneered by Ernest and John Lawrence at this very, very early stage. At the same time, Ernest was beginning to use the cyclotron to develop new isotopes that were not seen in the natural world, that he could create by bombarding existing elements. Some of these became very important diagnostic and curative tools in medicine as well.
You opened your book talking about the Higgs boson and how it has come out of big science. If you were going to say the other really big contributions that have come from this, essentially from this guy who transformed science and wedded it with government and big foundations, what would you say the other big contributions have been?
Well, I'd say if you look around, big science is all around us. It was critical in developing not only nuclear science, but also advances in biology. The Human Genome Project, that's a big science project. Addressing climate change, that's going to require big science. If we define big science as capital-intensive interdisciplinary research at a very basic level, then you can see that there's so much around us that depends on this paradigm. But at the same time, of course, it unleashed the destructive force of the nucleus as well. So I quoted in my book Raymond Fosdick, who was the chairman of the Rockefeller Foundation, who funded Ernest's largest cyclotron. This was in the late 1930s and early 1940s, who said, "We can't say science itself is good or evil. We can only talk about what humankind makes of this knowledge and these achievements." And I think that's the way we have to look at big science. It really, as I also quoted James Franck, who was a German emigre physicist who worked on the Manhattan Project and who knew Lorentz and who knew all this technology, he said, look, what we have done with big science is we have brought science past the point in which scientists can any longer disavow responsibility for their discoveries. There's just too much at stake. The destructive power of what we have discovered is greater than all the discoveries of mankind put together in the past. So I think big science has brought science to that point where scientists have to think about what the implications are of what they do. And this is very difficult both for science and for society at large, and I'm not sure we have solved that problem yet. But all we can say is that it's big science that still fulfills man's undying quest for knowledge in ever more important ways.
And it's also transformed the academy itself.
Well, it definitely has. The need to raise money, to marshal resources, and to manage these huge teams and huge funds really has turned university professors and university presidents into impresarios and promoters and CEOs. It's taken them away from the work of actually doing science in a way that I think has made many people uncomfortable, and rightly so. But I think that trend is only going to continue because big science itself drives its leaders to raise more money and build more to make science ever bigger, to answer ever bigger questions.
Michael Hiltzik, thank you for joining us again here on the Scholar Circle.
I'm happy to be here.
Michael Hiltzik is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. He's the author of 6 books, including the one we've been talking about, Big Science, Ernest Lorentz, and the Invention That Launched the Military-Industrial Complex. When we come back, the crisis in Yemen, what happened to get there, what should be done. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. After more than 2 years of civil war, famine, and cholera outbreaks, the country of Yemen is facing what observers call the worst humanitarian crisis on earth. Still, more than 100,000 teenagers from the Horn of Africa have made their way to Yemen by boat, based on a promise, usually by human traffickers, of finding work. Last week, one of those smugglers drowned some 50 of those seeking to better their lives. Joining us to shed some light on what's going on in Yemen are two experts. Dr. Charles Schmitz is a professor of geography at Towson University in Baltimore, Maryland. He served as president of the American Institute for Yemeni Studies, and he's an affiliate scholar with the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C. Professor Schmitz is the co-author of Historical Dictionary of Yemen. Hamoud Sahi also joins us. He is professor and dean of undergraduate studies at California State University, Dominguez Hills. He's also a host of Swana Regional Radio on KPFK in Los Angeles and a commentator for Arabic media.
Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have both of you with us to talk about this really important issue, particularly what's going on in Yemen, but really Yemen in the context of regional geopolitics and the global geopolitics as well. So thank you both for joining us here. So let's start with the current situation. I've been reading about a magnitude of humanitarian crises that seems to be among the worst in the world. Charles Schmidt, how would you describe what is happening in Yemen?
It is a humanitarian disaster. It has multiple dimensions. There is the war and there's casualties from war. But the larger issue is that the Yemeni economy has been in a tailspin and it basically has collapsed. So Yemen, through the 2000s, depended upon oil exports to import to pay for its consumer goods, basically. And the oil production has been totally stopped. A little bit has begun again, but the war disrupted it. The central bank has spent all of its foreign currency reserves. And Yemen depends entirely on imports for its food supplies. There are, you know, small amounts of food, but the basic staples of rice and wheat are wholly imported in Yemen. In addition to the fact that there is an air and sea blockade of the Houthi and Saleh forces by the Saudi-backed coalition with the United States and the British. And they expect the shipments to go in, and these have added a burden. But the real crisis is that the economy has collapsed and people don't have any money. You talk to people in Sana'a, the capital, which is in the Houthi-controlled areas, and there's food in the market. But what you don't see is that the bulk of people don't have the money to pay for it. So university professors, for example, are selling the furniture in their apartments in order to get some income to buy food. That's the real disaster.
I read also that doctors and nurses are dealing with a huge cholera outbreak and haven't been paid in months.
Nobody's been paid. The militia soldiers get some pay. When either side gets any income, and both have some sources of income, they primarily support the war effort. So they're paying soldiers. So if you're a soldier or running a militia, you're okay. But others don't have their income. Yes, there's a cholera outbreak. It's a result of the collapse of the government and the lack of basic services. So garbage was not being collected. There is no electricity. And the water services have collapsed as well. So the combination of them led to a cholera outbreak, which my understanding is that they're beginning to get a handle on, but it was a real disaster there for a while.
So back up just a bit in terms of the economy and the collapse of the economy. Historically, you said it has been reliant upon oil income to buy basic things like food and pay for the government. So this is all connected to a geopolitical conflict, is it?
The collapse of the economy is not directly related to the fighting. So Yemen had a long-time ruler, Adib al-Sadiq. He came to power in 1978. He ruled Yemen kind of as a soft authoritarian. In other words, Yemen after 1990, when it unified with the South, the former communist South, they had elections, multi-parties, freer press. His system of sort of patronage worked as long as he had funds to pay for things. In the prior period, in the 80s and 90s, Yemen depended upon worker remittances. A lot of Yemenis worked in Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states, and they sent worker remittances back. And then in the 2000s and the beginning of this decade, Yemen depended upon oil exports. And Saleh's system broke down. And when the Arab Spring broke out in 2011, he couldn't contain it. He couldn't contain two big issues. One is the Houthi rebellion in the north, and the second was the calls for independence in the south. The former communist south people there wanted to break away. And those two conflicts put pressure on the regime. He couldn't control it. In the Arab Spring, the inner core of his regime split in two, so some of his top military commanders split and went with the protesters. And then the Gulf states, in particular Saudi Arabia, stepped in and they had the GCC agreement, which in effect was an agreement with the Yemeni elite, most of the Yemeni elite, in which Saleh would step down from power but would remain in the country and would not be prosecuted for crimes of his regime. And that transitional government that began from 2012 and was supposed to go to 2014, everybody had great hopes for it. There was a national dialogue conference which all parties of Yemen came together to discuss, and including the southerners and including the Houthi in the north. But basically, that government failed. That government, backed by the Gulf states and by the United States and the international community, it didn't really have a lot of traction on the ground. And the Houthi movement began expanding from the north and came down. And unbeknownst to most, the former president allied with the Houthi and, in essence, took over Sana'a in a coup in early 2015. And the Houthi are friendly with the Iranians. They get some Iranian support, but very little. This is not Iraq or Hezbollah or even relations with the Syrian government. But the fact that the Houthi were friendly with the Iranians, the fact that the Houthi had basically turned over Saudi Arabia's key tribal alliances in the north of Yemen, and the Houthi now control them, this was very threatening to the Saudis. They launched a military campaign, which had a lot to do with internal Saudi politics as well, with the son of the king, who is the commander of the armed forces, and he's positioning himself to be king. He now is crown prince. The Saudis have rarely used their military extensively, and this is a major campaign that they are carrying out. And so this is a new symbolic forward policy for the Saudis that's connected with the crown prince's career. So it's very important to the Saudis. And so the Saudis and the Gulf states, they have a major, the Saudis have always had a major role in Yemen, but this is a particularly important role for them because they are intervening directly militarily.
Hamoud Salih, let's bring you in now. What would you add to this, both in terms of the current situation, the context with which we need to understand it, the sources of both the conflict and the economic collapse? What would you add?
Dr. Smith gave us an excellent overview. A few factors, the numbers a lot of time speak volume. The population, for example, of Yemen today is at around 27 million. Of those, over 18 million are in desperate need for basic necessities. You have more than 10 million who have serious, serious problems. So we're talking about famine, and we're talking about huge malnutrition. Yemen is one of the poorest countries in the world. It is expected that it will run out of water, if my memory doesn't fail me, by 2025. It's a country that has been sort of living in poor conditions for so many decades. It's ruled by alliances, centers around with a tribal leadership until 1996, when Dr. Schmidt talked a lot about this system. But a point that we need to emphasize is that the country was divided between the north and the south. The south was under brand of socialism. The north was morally aligned with the Saudis to a large degree. And then you have the Al-Qaeda that came into a perspective. Another reason one should look at is that the geopolitic of Yemen is very important. Back in 1981, when the Gulf Cooperation was created, Yemen is literally in the Gulf, but the GCC countries, including led by Saudi Arabia, refused to include them for two reasons. One is that it has a different system, and the other one, it was seen as it has a form of government that was not acceptable. It's different. It's somewhat, linking non-monarchical as the other states are, but it was strategic. It was very strategic for Yemen to have. The Yemenis, because of the vast majority of the population, provide labor to the GCC, and they are mistreated in more ways than one. What added to this crisis, to this recent crisis, is that when you define it as geopolitical, Yemen cannot be looked at outside what's happening in the Arab world. When we look at the Middle East as a system, you have the system is in crisis. The Arab world system has failed, and there is no reason for any hope. And what's happening in Yemen is the same thing that is happening elsewhere in Bahrain and to some degree in Syria. So it is representative of the failure of the Arab system. Second is the competition or the race for the hegemonic control of the Gulf region, namely between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Yemen became the center of a proxy war. The Saudis sees as a way for them to start stop or to undermine or to control Yemen in ways to protect their national interests. And the Iranians see this as a way to expect to give them strategic depth in the region. That kind of arms race in the region has impacted Yemen. The fact that today we have no Arab solution to the conflict, not a single interest, despite what's happening in Yemen, in malnutrition, in death, in tragedies unfolding in our east, there is no interest in it. It has in part because of the strategic fight that is between these two regional powers. And lastly, one should not ignore the health issues that are happening with cholera, as you mentioned correctly earlier. So a lot of ways, tragedy is unfolding before our eyes, and we continue to watch it. The Yemenis more and more going through from tragedy to another.
You know, we've been talking about the regional geopolitics, and you mentioned, Hamoud, about the other geopolitics and the potential role that can be played there. It seems that there is very little interest, as you alluded to, from the West, but there is some interest coming from, say, China now to take on a role of humanitarian aid. How do you see the West in all of this and its ostensible disinterest?
Well, you know, this is the challenge. What we've seen in the West is that the Middle East is used through two eyes, one through the Israeli politics and the other one, most recently, is through terrorism. Well, Yemen is looked at through the eyes of terrorism. So United States sends drones, kills people there, hurts civilians, and we call them casualties of war, and that's it. So we hear about instances of drones killing or doing some major damage to the country. At that time, we hear about it. So that prism of looking at Yemen in the interest of terrorism continues to prevail. As long as we are containing the threat of terrorism, of Al-Qaeda from expanding to the region, we are okay. And in that matter, you'll see Dr. Schmidt, for example, talks about oil. Well, one of the oil revenues or the oil areas are being controlled these days by the United Arab Emirates, and they are using non-governmental organizations as an umbrella to steal the oil resources and the gas resources from Yemen. The UAE is using Yemeni gas to compensate for what it's losing from its policy towards sanctioning Qatar. So again, here is an instance where what we may call international steal or pillage of a country, but it's also ignored. The idea of getting the West interested in Yemen under the current conditions is difficult to catch. And Yemen is not sexy, as their children seems to be not the same children as the one that showed up on the beaches of European with the Syrians and others. So it's very puzzling. And when you look at the tragedy, more than 60% of the population is severely under major dangers of losing their lives. That's really, it's a puzzle. So strategic goals, the roles that the Saudis play, the roles that the UAE is playing, is very significant. And add to this something that it's very important to look at, the change in leadership in the Gulf countries, in Saudi Arabia, in United Arab Emirates, even to Qatar, is playing a big, big, big role in this. The new leadership, it's a young leadership, educated in the West, having strong connection to the Western world, seems to care less about resolving conflict peacefully. It's the type of leadership that we have not seen in the past. The older leadership with Sheikh Zayed, for example, in United Arab Emirates, or Abdullah, or even Faisal, if you go back, they were able to work within a system to at least resolve those conflicts in ways that are in a bit human. And this new leadership seems to know how to address issues of the Western presence and seems to tack into it for its pure interest. And perhaps that also play a role in not shedding the lights that was supposed to be on this region, on Yemen specifically, yeah.
Charles Schmidt, what do you say to all of that? Do you see it in the same way?
It's quite a lot. Let's see. The last point about sort of the new military forward policies of the Emirates and the Saudis. They've been buying military equipment for a long time, but they haven't really used it. So this is the first time they've ventured out on their own and with the military. I would add to this that the United States and the European Union and the British have been very involved in Yemen. They were big backers of the transitional government, and they've been very concerned about what's going on. The Dutch in particular do a lot of work in Yemen. And there's a lot of relief work that's going on. But there was kind of a shift from the Obama to the Trump administration in the sense that the Obama administration tried to give Iran a place in the Middle East, to give it some sort of role that could be used to mold its behavior in such a way that it had an interest in the regional order. And the Trump administration rejects that. And they basically adopt the Gulf states' view of the conflict, which is that the primary problem, the primary enemy in the Middle East is Iran. And this has played out in Yemen. Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, he was the commander of the Central Command, which is that region. He served under Obama for a while, and then he left. And he was always critical of the failure in his eyes to stop Iranian expansion. And so they see this conflict in that light. But I think it's really important to say that it really doesn't fit that mold. In other words, the Iranians have spent nothing on Yemen, and they only see Yemen important in as much as it bothers the Saudis. This they like, that it has engaged the Saudis, that the Saudis are spending a lot of money on the war, that the Saudis are stuck in intractable conflict. The Iranians like this because it grinds the Saudis down, it grinds their military capabilities down. It was zero investment for the Iranians. This is not Hezbollah. This is not something where they spent a lot of time and effort developing. And the Iranians do not play a big role. Remember that the Houthi are under a naval and air blockade. Nothing gets in there without the UN inspecting it goes in. If the Iranians are getting in there, it's got to be smuggled in. And Yemen is famous for its smuggling. So, yes, this is one of the ways that the Houthi and Salak are staying around. But this is primarily about Saudi Arabia's influence. The relationship between Saudi Arabia and Yemen is very much like the United States and Mexico. The United States fears Mexico. It fears Mexico because of its poverty and its problems, its lack of state capacity spilling into the United States. And the Saudis feel the same about Yemen. They are afraid of Yemen because of its chaos. It's not a place that there's a strong central government. And so Al-Qaeda and other non-state actors, they can use it as a base, and they have used it as a base for attacks on Saudi Arabia. And the Gulf used to rely on Yemeni labor, but they don't like Yemeni labor. They prefer South Asian and Southeast Asian labor because they'll make no claims to citizenship. They'll make no claims to rights, whereas Yemenis who are culturally close and understand, they will make claims. They will say, you know, you're not treating us right. And so they much prefer South Asian labor to Yemeni labor. And so then what do they do with Yemen? Well, what the Saudis and the Gulf would like is to control it in such a way that Yemen is stable enough so that Yemenis stay there and Yemen doesn't implode and, you know, send many poor people across the border. Of course, their intervention has done exactly that. So it seems to have backfired. I wanted to say one more thing. Dr. Hamoud said something very important, and that is that, you know, we don't have Yemeni children washing up on beaches. Yemenis don't get the attention that, say, the Syrians or the Iraqis or others do because Yemenis are trapped. You can't get out. There's no way to get out of Yemen. Syrians can run across the border to Lebanon. They can go to sea. They can cross the Mediterranean, et cetera, et cetera. Iraqis can do this as well. The Yemeni can't. And so because there is no Yemeni component to the refugee crisis in Europe, they don't get as much attention.
You know, it's interesting, the issue about being trapped, and then the big news item this week about the smuggled Ethiopians and Somalis that were drowned off the coast of Yemen. How do we make sense of all of this?
As incredible as it sounds, Yemen is the poorest Arab country, but Yemen is about on par with the average of sub-Saharan Africa. And Somalis are much worse off. And so the direction of migration is from Somalia to Yemen, and there are Somali refugee camps along the south. And recently they've been in the news because it's not clear exactly why, but the Somali smugglers have feared Yemeni gunboats, probably, and they've been dumping their human cargo farther off the coast, and many of them have drowned. And that has just started in the last, 2 weeks. There's been a number of incidents where the smugglers simply force everybody at gunpoint off the boat and too far off the coast, and so a lot of them drowned when they're coming in. It's not clear why people speculate that some sort of Yemeni security is, because they're not supposed to do this. This is illegal. And it's ironic that Yemenis can't get out of their crisis, but here Somalis are being added to it.
I was wondering, now, they are locked in because they're obviously on the sea on one side, and on the other, is it just they just can't get through the borders?
Right. There are no flights out of Sana'a right now. You could smuggle yourself across the border into Oman, but see, it's got a border with Oman, and the longest border is with Saudi Arabia, which is, of course, is a war zone, and they've cut it off. And then there are boats. There's no real way, you know, to sort of, I don't know what you do, get on a raft, try and float through the Suez Canal. I don't think it's possible. So there's really no place to go.
And so we were going to talk through now possible ways of making a big difference for these people in Yemen who are clearly going to starve to death and die of disease if some things aren't done. I know there's humanitarian aid coming in, but clearly this can't go on just based on humanitarian aid. What are the, you know, economic, political solutions that need to occur?
There has to be negotiations between the Houthi and Salak. Salak is the former ruler, and he's allied himself with the Houthi. There has to be negotiations between Salak and the Houthi and the Saudis on the one hand, and Houthi and Salak and the Hadi government, which is the Saudi-backed government, which is in Riyadh and in Aden. There has to be negotiations with them. The difficulty is that the Hadi government has UN Resolution 2216, which calls for the restoration of the Hadi government in Sana'a and the withdrawal of the Houthi from the cities. In essence, it's asking to give Hadi what they couldn't achieve on the battleground. So it's not a very workable solution at this point. What needs to happen is a gradual de-escalation where kind of a third power can emerge. It's not Salak and Houthi, and it's not the Hadi government, but it is a neutral set of powers that can oversee the formation of a new national reconciliation government. And it sounds pie in the sky, but in Yemen it's not. They've done such things. And in fact, in early 2016, there were negotiations in Dahran al-Junubi, which is in Saudi Arabia, where they actually started to do this. And they put together military committees to de-escalate the various conflicts, areas in the conflicts. And it has to be that kind of thing. It's not going to be kind of a, you know, a UN conference and blah, blah, blah. It's going to be a step-by-step, area-by-area de-escalation, military de-escalation, and you start to build trust between the parties. And there has to be a national reconciliation government, which is neither Houthi nor on the Hadi side.
Hamoud Salhi, do you agree?
Those are really some fundamental issues that we have to deal with. But there are a couple other things that might be sort of also important. I think one of the issues, if we look at some of the resolutions that have been passed in the Security Council at this point, there is a path for some kind of reconciliation. There is some kind of path for rewriting the Constitution, for drafting a national government in ways that would be sort of creating a balance, giving some power to the Houthis at the national level. So there has been some discussion, there has been some progress on that. I think the biggest problem is with the Syrian conflict and then the humanitarian issue, which creates more and more and more problems. And of course, with that sorted out, you have the issue of terrorism. A solution to Yemen is closely linked with other issues. Syria is a bit far, but it's also linked to Bahrain, where Iran, despite Dr. Schmidt is very correct when he's saying that their involvement in Yemen are not to the extent that what has been portrayed in the media. But Bahrain is a very important case to look at. Again, you have a Shia population supported by Iran. You still have the Shia in Bahrain struggling, and you have arrests that continue to be a problem. So the issue of resolving Yemen could be linked to resolutions at the regional level between the Saudis and the Iranian, and play linking those issues. What we've seen in the 90s, late 90s, when Khatami was in power, the Gulf countries, the leaders of that region, saw a detente, or the Iranians and the Saudis and the entire GCC at the time, except for the United Arab Emirates, reached out to the Iranians, Mohammed Said Khatami, and there were relationships that today still exist, particularly those between the Qataris and the Iranian. The point is this: there is a way out also for the Yemenis to, if the main regional powers are able to sort of resolve or come to a consensus on an agreement on how to put their differences aside. This, of course, is linked to Syria and linked to other issues, but there is also some important issue, something to do there. The other thing is that we slowly start to see the importance of this colonial or post-colonial entity, the Arab League, that had some power in the past, albeit, you know, very, very weak. But the fact that bringing leaders to a forum, bringing the Arab leaders to a place where they can negotiate and discuss with each other, that brought some kind of appeasement or resolution to conflicts. The Saudis, for example, were notorious for bribing other leaders to ensure that the conflict don't expand. So you have those kind of approaches were successful. Recently, there has been some declaration from the Secretary General of the Arab League pointing out to the need to remind the Arab leaders and the international players or countries of the need to respect the Arab state sovereignty and not to go into this idea of continuously fragmenting the state from another. But the significance of that is that the Arab League could also play a role in this, despite its weakness, in bringing all the parties together. So I guess from one perspective, one could be saying that there are a lot of parts to this resolution, but in the end, what will sort of play a role in this is having a balanced approach between all parties. We've seen, for example, that the Saudis are continuously promoting al-Hadi and presenting him as the president of the country at the expense of other groups. So doing a balance, promoting leaders, Dr. Schmidt talked about other players, is a very, very significant. A deeper issue is the relationship between the North and the South. This is a long conflict, and the plan in the Constitution of dividing the country into several provinces. So there are some ways there to work on, but it takes dedication. It takes also belief in the process, and more than anything else, it takes the Yemenis to be on the same page and agreeing that for the sake to protect their countries, that foreign presence or foreign interference should stay out.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for your time and your thoughts and your research.
Thank you.
Dr. Charles Schmitz is a professor of geography at Towson University in Baltimore, Maryland, and he's an affiliate scholar with the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C. Professor Schmitz is the co-author of Historical Dictionary of Yemen. Hamoud Sahi is professor and dean of undergraduate studies at California State University, Dominguez Hills. He's a commentator for Arabic media.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.